Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I am delighted to be back with you after three Thursdays of disruption related to the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, and then by Thanksgiving last Thursday. First, I just want to say I appreciate that Progressive Radio Network gave over their studio to BAI for about 10 days after the storm. And I appreciate the special report that Gary Null presented the next week about what really happened and did not happen with regard to the FEMA and other responses. I also hope that the people who lost so much in the storm realize that people around the country are still sending in checks and holding them in our thoughts. And I hope you all know you can go to the website called charitynavigator.org and see which nonprofits have really high ratings for keeping a low overhead and really doing a lot of good with the money you send them. Well, I have so much to catch up with you about. You may recall that Marianne Williamson was on this show in late September, and she was talking about the gathering that she hosted called Sister Giant in L.A. This happened recently on November 10th and 11th, and the aim was to get more women to run for public office and to run on a more deeply grounded politics. And there was a lot of focus on the child poverty levels in this country and the high levels of imprisonment compared to any other country, industrialized country, really any country, and also the effects of the Citizens United decision, just as three examples of issue areas. Well, nearly 1,500 women registered. Many of them were watching it via live streaming, but people came from all over the United States. Counting both ways you could attend the conference, there were people from all 50 states and eight foreign countries present. And I spoke on Saturday morning. It will come as no surprise to listeners of this program that I talked about the relational shift that's moving through our institutions and systems of knowledge right now, which is what this program tracks. It's the continuation of all the findings I put together for the book last year, Relational Reality. So if you're interested in seeing what's happening now, once you see them gathered in the book Relational Reality, you can see them in the media every month. You'll be able to connect the dots because these experiments are still happening. And the write-up usually said, oh, the researchers were surprised to find that, and it's all about dynamic interrelatedness, that the physical world, including us, is way, way more dynamically interrelated than even holistic thinkers might have imagined about 10 years ago. So, since it was a women's conference, I also brought things around at the end of the talk to implications for women and other relational thinkers, particularly with the famous tests in 1954 on perception that found a big gender gap. And it found that men tend to look at this abstract pattern that was shown to them, two different ones, by focusing on the foreground figures and ignoring the context, and that the women always saw the gestalt. They always saw the dynamic interrelatedness. They saw the totality. Of course, they saw the foreground figures, but they saw how instantly that they are embedded in this context. So they saw the totality. And now that all these scientific discoveries are saying, oh, gee, everything's really dynamically interrelatedness. It's that talent to see dynamic interrelatedness in every situation that's really needed now in society to bring this grand correction to fruition. So those classic perception tests, by the way, were given a patriarchal spin by the researcher, Professor Witkin. And he said, oh, the men are field independent. They just zero right in on those foreground figures and ignore the background. But the women, they're field dependent. They seem to be influenced by things around what they're supposed to be looking at. So that led to all kinds of articles about women being childish, immature thinkers, easily affected by others. And all I've got to say to that 50 years later, actually 60, laugh while you can, monkey boy, because things are shifting in the direction of people who can see situations as being dynamically interrelated. And I mentioned, I think on the last show, check out the October 22nd issue of The New Yorker. There's a big article on bacteria reconsidered. Microbiology, the whole field going off the mechanistic model onto the relational model of understanding how bacteria works in our bodies to prevent illness as well as cause it. Anyway, it was a fantastic conference, and you can check out the website, sistergiant.com. They have streaming video up there, and they'll be posting all kinds of things in the future. At the end of the weekend, Marianne Williamson asked women who had decided during the weekend to run for office to come up on the stage. It's a big stage. And people stood up and started streaming down the two main aisles. They just kept coming and coming and coming. It was really something to see. The whole stage was filled pretty quickly, and there were still people filling the aisles leading up to the stage. So it was very exciting. Because I know people always say, oh, gee, but what about Maggie Thatcher? Women in office might not make a difference. Well, just this morning I read about the parliament in Rwanda. And following all the genocide and horror there, the new laws require a lot more women to be represented in the parliament. It's now the only parliament with over 50% women, and they're permitted to be there as inter-party parliamentarians. So they're not confined by the political bickering of any party. And they have made big changes for the better in child welfare and all kinds of aspects of society that's needed to recover and to grow as a society. So it does make a difference. Anyway, just one more thing. Last week I noticed in the newspaper that there's this new organization, and it's for people 18 to 34. It's called the Can Kicks Back. And the newspaper article I saw, it said that they're concerned that their fate is like a can being kicked down the road by not addressing the federal debt now. So, and they're planning to open 500 chapters on college campuses and elsewhere. So I thought, well, gee, maybe this is the big uprising I've been waiting for among young adults to say, yeah, we do want the debt cleared in the obvious ways. You need to close some of those 724 military bases around the world, which is a huge drain of tax money. And no one else even comes close to running that many military bases outside of their own country. And also, you need to restore the revenue streams. So return the taxes to the 1990 levels, except for people making under $100,000 a year. And then, of course, Social Security is a separate issue. It has nothing to do with the federal debt because it has its own revenue stream. Well, I went to the website of the Can Kicks Back expecting to find a lot of good rabble-rousing, and it turns out that it's an extension of the Simpson-Bowles Commission horrors. They're both on the advisory board, so it's something they started up to try to convert young people. And I hope you understand, if you're in that age group, that going along with the Simpson-Bowles proposals would completely mess you over for decades, because they want to do a little, for one thing, they have Social Security as if it were a problem on the federal debt, which it's not. But their answer to Social Security is, oh, we'll do a little bit here. We'll raise the caps on taxable income a little bit, and we'll cut people's benefits a little bit, and we'll cut the cost of living increase a little bit, and we'll increase the tax, payroll tax for Social Security a little bit. None of that is necessary if only one thing were done, and that's to democratize the Social Security tax. I said this before, we have a flat tax on Social Security, but it's not applied equally to everyone. People who make over $110,000 just stop paying. So that's not fair. If that were fixed, if the caps on taxable income for Social Security tax were abolished, Social Security would be in clover, certainly through your lifetime and your children's probably. And finally, the Democrats are actually saying, after all this time about, oh, isn't Simpson-Bowles a wonderful solution? Now President Obama and Harry Reid said yesterday, you know, Social Security shouldn't really be part of this debt discussion we're having now because it has nothing to do with the federal debt. It's never contributed a dime of debt to the federal debt. It has its own revenue stream, right? So they're trying to finally take that out of the discussion on this fiscal cliff, budgetary decisions. But there are a whole lot of decisions on the table now, and I hope people will really make a noise and email your congressperson or initiate a flash mob or something, because they need to restore the revenue streams and cut the military budget. If they would do those two things, we wouldn't have a 500,000 people in one state alone, California, being turned away from the community colleges in recent years. I mean, I've had people say to me, oh, you know, pork projects need to be cut. The community college system is not a pork project. So we have to get the public revenues back, at least to the way they were in the 1990s. And I think it was a real day of infamy when Nancy Pelosi suggested last year, well, we want to not renew the Bush tax cuts except for people making up to $1 million a year. Really? This is the Democratic Party? And then President Obama said, oh, no, we'll just renew them except for people making up to $250,000 a year. Now, people making $250,000 a year had no problem paying the tax level in the 1990s. The only reason they're pandering up there above where it probably should be set around $100,000, if you make under $100,000 or under $75,000, you maybe need tax relief. But the reason he's putting up to $250,000 is that's the sweet spot for campaign donations, people making up to $250,000 a year. So once again, in lieu of campaign finance reform, we're getting skewed public policy. Of course, it's not clear how it's going to turn out yet, but really, this is the time to squawk and make some noises about budgetary decisions that are really not even being discussed. They're not on the table because people have to put them there. Well, moving on, we're going to hear today about an extremely impressive grassroots global organization called United Religions Initiative. I was honored to be part of their early conferences held south of San Francisco in the mid-1990s, that was. They flew in people from all over the world from a variety of religions and spiritual orientations. Really a wide variety, not stopping with, you know, the big five or whatever. And the organizers also brought in some experts in facilitation techniques from a program at Case Western Reserve University. So we had lots of well-focused discussions with lots of big pieces of paper taped to the walls filled with interesting suggestions. But after 2 or 3 years, nothing much came of all these discussions. Until someone at United Religions Initiative got the brilliant idea to start cooperation circles around the world. These are local, self-organized groups consisting of at least 7 people from at least 3 faith traditions, and can include people with no faith tradition, who get together and decide on a project that needs to be done locally to further interfaith cooperation and peace building, conflict resolution, to share perspectives from different traditions, or offer humanitarian relief, or organize music festivals, clean rivers, offer hospice counseling, develop educational programs, create opportunities for intercultural encounters and interfaith reflection, and lots of other activities. And it's all self-generated at the local level. No one tells these cooperation circles what project they should be doing. And there are now about 550 United Religion Initiative cooperative circles in 79 countries around the world. So I just think this is a very interesting model. And my guest today is the executive director of United Religions Initiative since 1999. The Reverend Canon Charles P. Gibbs is an internationally respected spiritual leader, interfaith activist, speaker, and writer. He feels blessed to have been given the opportunity to collaborate with remarkable leaders around the world. He has spoken and written extensively about spiritual growth and interfaith cooperation as tools to building a better world. Along with his colleague, Sally Mahay, he co-authored a book about the birth of United Religions Initiative entitled Birth of a Global Community. He's an Episcopal priest and a poet committed to spiritual transformation and working for peace, justice, and healing, as well as an abiding belief in the sacredness of all life on this planet. Charles Gibbs, welcome to All Together Now. Well, oh, I see. I've just gotten a message from the sound engineer at Progressive Radio Network that he's calling him back to get the connection back. So let me just say while we're waiting, they have regional coordination of these cooperation circles once they're locally established. And they also establish what they call systems of influence, where the cooperation circles link up with other groups in the area. So they find like-minded people who do want to work toward greater understanding and conflict resolution. And I want to give you an example of some of their recent projects. They have a young leaders program, and this nurtures and trains stellar, as they say, young leaders. Last year's youth ambassadors touched the lives of over 2,500 people through local youth-led service projects. And the third cohort of these youth ambassadors will soon see new teams at work in Africa, North America, Europe, and Latin America. And by the way, one thing about their governing board, it really is planetary. It's true, it was started by a white male North American Christian, the Episcopal Bishop, William Swig. Starting in 1993, he started getting the idea for this. And then Charles Gibbs was brought in early on to serve as the executive director. But right away, it really was a planetary organization. You can look at their governing board on the website, uri.org. Okay, Charles Gibbs, are you with us?
I am, Charlene. Good to hear your voice.
Oh, good. Okay, well, you missed your introduction, but they know who you are.
Oh, good. I do some days, but not always.
It says on your website that the purpose of the United Religions Initiative is to promote enduring daily interfaith cooperation, to end religiously motivated violence, and to create cultures of peace, justice, and healing for the earth and all living beings. That sounds mighty fine to me, and I wonder if we could go back to the beginning and hear about how it all started.
Sure. I like to say that's the sentence that took 4 years to write. but if you dial back, you just mentioned 1993 when the Episcopal Bishop here in San Francisco, Bill Swing, was invited by the UN to host a one-hour interfaith service in 1995 that would be part of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the signing of the UN Charter in San Francisco. Out of that, for him, came a recognition that in the UN, nations of the world were working together for the common good, but the religions who were invited to the celebration weren't working together for the common good. Often they were part of the problem, rarely collectively part of the solution. So from the beginning, URI has been an effort to find ways to bring people of different faiths together to work for the common good. Very early on, the vision changed from high-level interreligious diplomacy to grassroots interfaith organizing around the world. We spent 4 years from 1996 to 2000 engaging thousands of people around the world in really in an exercise of imagining into being an organization that could be owned by everyone, but would belong uniquely to no one. Mm-hmm. That would have the purpose statement that you just read, that we're committed to promoting enduring daily interfaith cooperation, to ending religiously motivated violence, and to creating cultures of peace, justice, and healing for the earth and all living beings. Mm-hmm. And that line really speaks with the voices of thousands of people from around the world, and their Muslim voices and Jewish voices and Hindu and Buddhist and Jain and Baha'i and Zoroastrian and Sikh and Christian and indigenous, pagan, on and on, atheist voices. People who said, now is the time for us to claim a new part of our destiny, and it's a destiny to be claimed through working in self-organizing ways in the grassroots to create new communities that have never existed before between people of different faiths, recognizing that we really are, as Martin Luther King said, bound together in a web of destiny.
Mm-hmm. I can well appreciate your saying that that simple statement of purpose took 4 years to write, because I was part of that group that was invited to form a draft of the charter initially. We met at that interfaith project in the Presidio. And
indeed you were.
Looking at the charter, beautiful charter, on your website now, I see how much it's evolved beyond the original rough cut. And the other thing I remember from those years, early on, right with that first conference, I know you say they were happening around the world, but of course I was at the ones that were in the San Francisco area, where
right.
people flew in from many countries as well as around North America and South America. But I was impressed with Bishop Swing saying that he was really traveling around the world trying to invite all kinds of spiritual orientations that he could encounter. In other words, he wasn't just going for sort of the big five, but he was also welcoming people who situate themselves in neo-paganism or goddess spirituality. And that to me was very different, coming from sort of an establishment figure like an Episcopalian bishop. So I think that should be said as well. You're really serious about being inclusive in the broadest way.
Well, you know, the interfaith world has journeyed a long way since URI's early beginnings. But when we started, so much of what was central to interfaith work was still a very sort of elitist effort at high-level inter-religious dialogue with
right.
scholars and high-level religious leaders, and often a question of who should and who shouldn't be included. And often it was the great historic religions who were included. We became clear very early on that people around the world wanted the door to be a very wide one and the table big enough that anyone from any tradition who was willing to work in an atmosphere of mutual respect and work cooperatively together would be welcome, because we felt ultimately the community would not be complete until everyone was at the table.
Right. Now, I spoke, I think, back when the connection was lost about cooperation circles, and how
yeah.
I think that's such a brilliant model, because it allows for the initiative to reside at the local level with this simple mm-hmm. guideline of having at least 7 people from at least 3 faith traditions, or you can include people who don't situate themselves in a faith tradition, but to decide what really could help things along in the local situation. So I just want to give a few more examples for the listeners of what some of these cooperation circles around the world are doing. Winning full citizenship for poor and disenfranchised brick workers in Pakistan, rescuing so-called child soldiers in the Ugandan Civil War, brokering a truce between factions of the Christian Church in Kerala, India, working with government officials, teachers, and police to increase social cohesion and stem violence before it starts in urban areas of Catalonia, urban reforestation in New Delhi in India, and helping religious and cultural minorities in the conflict-prone province of Mindanao in the Philippines have their voice heard by government officials in Manila. So I've always wondered whose idea was the cooperation circles. It's so brilliant.
Well, it was, I think, like most great ideas, something that emerged in many aha moments over time. But in the 4 years we were creating URI's charter, we asked people around the world to imagine the kind of organization they would want to be a part of. And we heard that people wanted to be part of something global that was much bigger than themselves.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't want a global headquarters bossing them around. So there was a sense that people all over the world wanted connection, but they also wanted local autonomy. We were clear as we worked on the purpose statement that interfaith cooperation was a critical point of this. So we were clear that our groups needed to be vehicles for interfaith cooperation, which meant they had to have people of different faiths. And we started drawing pictures on napkins of what that might look like. And uh-huh. as we were hitting the wall, realizing we could draw pictures, but we didn't really know how to translate that into an organizational design, we began working with Dee Hock, who at that point had founded the Chaotic Alliance, mm-hmm. building on ideas of chaotic organizing that blend chaos and order and really picture systems that are highly adaptive and self-organizing. And out of our work with him, with a design team that had people from all over the world, we slowly evolved the preamble, purpose, and principles of our charter, and then created the concept of cooperation circles as a simple, elegant, and easy way for people to form new community and become members of URI. We discovered when we signed the charter that the people who'd been involved in helping make that real were also the seed of the new global community. I believe we had 85 founding cooperation circles when mm-hmm. we signed the charter. And mm-hmm. from 35 different countries since then, we've grown to over 560 cooperation circles in 83 countries. So the model, which really came out of the wisdom of people on the ground and an organizational visionary who helped shape our thinking, has been field-tested now for 12 years, and it seems to be a really effective model that attracts lots of people to URI, but also we see these kinds of circles emerging in lots of other organizations as well.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be an attractive model. And what's the nature of regional coordination? Do they send a representative to a regional meeting or something, or how does that work?
Well, when we were designing URI, we realized that it would be a long distance between a global office and work on the ground all over the world. So we set up a regional structure to try to have a connecting link between certain areas mm-hmm. And the global. The global is manifest, as you indicated, by our Global Council, which has representatives elected by our members all over the world. I think our current Global Council, which is fairly newly elected, has members from 19 different countries. Our chair is a young Hindu woman from the UK. Our vice chair is a young Palestinian man from Hebron. Mm-hmm. So we have that diversity, but we have staff on the ground in 7 different geographic regions. They anchor the outreach to cooperation circles. They help plan strategy to support cooperation circles, to develop new ones, to enhance the capacity of the groups that are in place to increase their work. You mentioned the work in northern Uganda around child soldiers and the work in India, but mediating conflict between two Christian factions. Both of mm-hmm. those circles were part of a 2-year peace-building training project that we did. Uh-huh. And their work, which was good to start with, I think really benefited from having 2 years of capacity building.
Uh-huh. Great. We have to pause here for a moment for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Reverend Charles Gibbs, on All Together Now. Welcome back. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, the Reverend Charles Gibbs, on All Together Now. And the website, again, for his organization, United Religions Initiative, a planetary grassroots organization, is URI.org. I would like to ask you, Charles, what the effect on United Religions initiatives and the cooperation circles were in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks?
First of all, I think in the moment of that, it was a test early on for URI to see if there was a way to exercise a global voice from all this very diverse community we were a part of. And we had an interesting exercise early on. Our, at that point, Interim Global Council, which met the day after those bombings in a really stirring meeting, mm-hmm. That was supposed to be filled with business and instead was this outpouring of grief and anguish by people all over the world. I'll never forget that, because in that moment, it seemed like everyone in the world was one family, mm-hmm. In pain and suffering. And coming out of that, there was a real desire to speak about a different kind of future that wouldn't resort to hatred and violence, that would instead work to build bridges of cooperation. And we were able very easily to put out on behalf of the Global Council a statement that was a clarion call to living at a higher level of consciousness and cooperation. And I think that has challenged us ever since, in the midst of increasing difficulties and violence in some areas, to really stick to that vision. There's also been a huge awakening in the world to the importance of engaging religion as part of the solution, rather than leaving people of faith out in the hallway thinking they would just create more problems. Right. So there's been more and more interfaith work around the world, and I think our local groups have found themselves often turned to more as resources by local governments, national governments. Beyond that, I think a sense that we really do have to be weaving together a new kind of community, moving beyond what political leaders, military leaders might get to on their own. We need to be creating on the ground a new fabric of community that includes people as a way to move beyond the divisions that lead to violence. So I think there's been a clarion call both from within URI to rise to a higher level of community, but also from the world around for us to improve our work, to be increasingly effective mm-hmm. in what we do. Mm-hmm. And I know one particular manifestation of that, as both immediately after 9/11 and still over the years, we began to hear more and more the two words put together, Muslim terrorist, to really be conscious of building bridges of understanding and solidarity with Muslim communities, battling against rising Islamophobia, whether it's here in this country or in immigrant populations through Europe, that there is so much good URI can accomplish by being a model of unity when so much of the world seems to be wanting to pull apart.
Mm-hmm. And
URI is involved not only in the Islamic communities in Europe and North America, as you say, but it's also involved in the Middle East. So could you tell us about some of the activities there and projects?
Sure. We have, in fact, as we're talking, many of our representatives from cooperation circles in the Middle East and North Africa are gathering in Amman for an annual regional assembly, and the theme is the social responsibility in religious traditions, a time for forgiveness. And in a climate where there's both the exhilaration of the sort of moving forward into a new reality of the Arab Spring, the ongoing agony of what's happening between Israelis and Palestinians, URI leaders struggle, I think, heroically to be part of positive change. And they do it in practical ways, first of all, by modeling that we don't have to be enemies of each other because we happen to be Muslim and Jewish and Christian and Druze, that we can be colleagues and allies of each other. So whether it's women's groups, which are so important and so powerful, coming together and at the beginning just to create models of community when Jews and Muslims and Christians and Druze aren't talking with each other, to be brave enough and often heroic in saying, we will continue to meet and get to know each other. We will grieve each other's losses as our own, and we will work for each other's rights as our own. To see the growing presence of URI women's groups in the Middle East and North Africa is one inspiring thing. To see people of different faiths come together and work to help address the needs of the people who are impoverished in a particular country. For instance, in Jordan, to see young professionals who give sacrificially of their time and then their income to be able to assist people who are living way in the margins of society, to see people addressing environmental issues in a whole myriad of ways, coming together and saying, there are so many urgent needs, our cooperation is needed, and we'll create that model and pray and hope that the political leaders will follow.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, all this time I've been reading about the cooperation circles, it never dawned on me that there might be all women circles. Are there, and how does that work? What are they doing?
Sure. Well, I think in many parts of the world there are. It's interesting, Charlene, when we first started going, one of the reasons to go into the grassroots, one of many, was that you could work with women. People all over the world said one of the most hopeful things about our time in history is the increasing presence of women in leadership roles in all areas of life.
Mm-hmm.
So the inclusion of women, women's voices in leadership, has been critical from the beginning. We have an extraordinary coordinator in the western part of India around Mumbai who does remarkable grassroots organizing in communities where the abuse of women, where dowry killings, where female infanticide are huge issues, and she helps women, Hindu and Muslim and Christian, Buddhist women, organize together to work to create a reality beyond those horrific practices. That's one example. In the Middle East, I know one group began simply by risking bringing people of different faiths to get to know each other and trading recipes. And now they're doing ongoing education, having peace-building training so that the women can be a more vital force for peace in Israel-Palestine, but more broadly in the region. In Africa, we see women coming together to work for women's education, for the rights of women. In Pakistan, we have a women's desk. That desk works to help provide education and opportunities for livelihood for women. So I think in many parts of the world, you see women taking really remarkable leadership.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear that's happening within URI. Sounds like it's very central. What are some of the challenges you've run into by situating the weight and the bulk of your planetary organization at the grassroots level?
Well, one of the challenges is that it would be very easy for this sprawling network to be so diffuse that it ends up being a bunch of cooperation circle islands around the world and not really a global network.
Right.
I think that is at the top of the list of challenges, and it's why we have the regional structure that I was mentioning earlier, why we have made an effort to provide easy means for cooperation circles around the world to be in communication with each other. So there really is a sense of global community so that people working on similar issues can find each other and learn from each other, can plan together and maybe do common projects. That dimension of our work is I think one challenge. Another would be honoring the autonomy of local groups. How do we help with capacity building that doesn't take away their rights but helps them do the work they want to do more effectively? And our peace building work is an example of that. Building a young leaders network is another. How do we help everyone be more effective at bringing in young leaders? Those are examples. And finally, I suppose, like just about any organization in existence, the challenge of keeping an adequate financial base under the work. Our local groups are all self-funding, so the amount of resource that's generated through the cooperation circles for their own work, both human and financial, is huge. The cost of keeping a global network alive is pretty substantial, and we work hard year-round, year after year, to keep that moving forward, because the growth of the organization doesn't recognize what the bank account looks like. So the blessing of this organization that continues to grow and to grow creates with it the challenge and invitation for us to be as effective as we can in the organizing we do and in the fundraising we do.
And then I mentioned in passing early on you have this program training youth leaders. Could you explain how that works?
Yes, it began really when we realized that it was critically important to have young people involved, and we didn't have any formal mechanism to do that. So we created a young leaders program that began in a formal way in 2010 with a gathering in Mayapur, India, that brought young people from all over the world together. And that created our young leaders program. It has evolved into a program that now has two dimensions: the global, which is led by a young man named Matthew Ude, who lives in the UK, and a Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area program, led by a young woman here in our San Francisco office named Krithika Harish. They work together as a team. Krithika is largely trying to pilot a local effort that can be replicated. Matthew continues to build our global work that goes from region to region to do trainings, and he and Krithika often work together on those. They did a training together in Latin America last year. But those trainings that bring together young people, and we've had them in Europe, we've had them in the Middle East, we've had them in Africa, and our ambassadors program, which identifies promising young leaders and honors them and puts them in a structure where they can be mentored, where they develop relationships with the other ambassadors, and go to work implementing some kind of very specific project that can make a positive difference in their communities. That creates a larger and larger cohort of inspired and inspiring young leaders who have the capacity to be positive change agents. And we see those people. For instance, I mentioned our global council chair is a young Hindu woman from the UK. She was part of the coordinating team for that young leaders program in 2010. Now she's the head of our global council. The value of the vision and energy of young people is something that becomes increasingly important in URI. And you see it in many parts of the world. So many of our leaders, for instance, in the Middle East and North Africa, are younger. And they are impatient with the structures that have mired their countries and their region in so much conflict and oppression. And they're willing to step forward and take the risks of creating something new in the belief that they can help create something that's better.
We have just about a minute left here, but I wonder if you could say something about URI's particular approach to peace building. I know there are different approaches. Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication asks people to sit in a circle and mention their unmet needs in a certain situation. What's really so deeply wrong about this situation in terms of your own unmet needs? Do you have a particular approach in the peace building trainings?
I would say, first of all, there are many different ways URI people practice peace building, but the focus we used in our training that we will continue to move forward comes from John Paul Lederach's approach that he articulates in his book called The Moral Imagination, The Art and Soul of Peace Building, where he says we need to be able, while we're standing in the challenges, which are often violent, of the present context, we need to be able to imagine and help bring into being the new we want to inhabit. And to do that, we need to be able to imagine ourselves in a web of relationship that includes our enemies. We need to see the complexities of situations, not to default to this dualistic right and wrong, good and bad. We need to be able to develop our capacity for creativity, because the breakthroughs in peace building often come from a creative act, a spontaneously creative act.
That sounds exactly right. We're out of time, but could you say the title of that book again, The Moral Imagination?
The Art and Soul of Peace Building.
Okay, that's the subtitle, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Reverend Charles Gibbs, for coming on All Together Now.
Thank you, Charlene, and keep up the great work.
Thanks, you too. Oh, let's move on over to the Arts Corner now. And our poem this week is one by Galway Cannell. I first read him eons ago in a poetry class in college, and I'm delighted to say that he's still alive and still writing, and in recent years writing some of his best poetry, in my view. He's a former Poet Laureate of Vermont, a former MacArthur Fellow, a winner of the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. This poem is entitled Why Regret by Galway Cannell from the collection Strong is Your Hold, which is a line from Walt Whitman. Okay. Why Regret? Didn't you like the way the ants helped the peony globes open by eating the glue off? Weren't you cheered to see the iron workers sitting on an I-beam dangling from a cable in a row, like starlings eating lunch, maybe bologna on white with fluorescent mustard? Wasn't it a revelation to waggle from the estuary all the way up the river? The kill, the Pearly, the run, the rent, the beck, the psych barely trickling to the shock of a spring? Didn't you almost shiver hearing book lice clicking their sexual dissonance inside an old Webster's New International, perhaps having just eaten out of it, Eisel, Zister, Thalassicon? What did you imagine lies in wait anyway at the end of a world whose sub-substance is glame, gleet, birdlime, slime, mucus, muck? Forget about becoming emaciated. Think of the wren and how little flesh is needed to make a song. Didn't it seem somehow familiar when the nymph split open and the mayfly struggled free and flew and perched, and then its own back broke open with the imago, the true adult, somersaulted out and took flight, seeking the swarm, mouth parts, vestigial, alimentary canal come to a stop, a day or hour left to find the desired one? Or when Casanova took up the platter of linguine in squid's ink and slid the stuff out the window, telling his startled companion, "The perfected lover does not eat." As a child, didn't you find it calming to imagine pinworms as some kind of tiny batons giving cadence to the squeezes and releases around the downward march of debris? Didn't you glimpse in the monarchs what seemed your own inner blazonry, flapping and gliding in desire in the middle air? Weren't you reassured to think these flimsy hinged beings, and then their offspring, and then their offspring's offspring, could navigate working in shifts all the way to Mexico, to the exact plot, perhaps the very tree, by tracing the flare of the bodies of ancestors who fell in this same migration a year ago? Doesn't it outdo the pleasures of the brilliant concert to wake in the night and find ourselves holding hands in our sleep? For our song this week, well, let's try to stay focused, folks, on making a ruckus about all the crucial budget issues that are being decided right now in Washington. Email your congressperson or do something. They really need to restore the revenue streams. Maybe they'll do that. Maybe they'll cut the defense budget by closing some of those 725 U.S. military bases around the world. Maybe they'll democratize the Social Security tax. Maybe they will, if pushed. For now, let's hear Maybe Baby by Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby, you'll be true. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. It's funny, honey, you don't care. You never listen to my prayer. Maybe, baby, you will love me someday. Well, you are the one that makes me glad, and you are the one that sad up when someday you want me. Well, I'll be there, wait and see. Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby, you'll be true. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. Sad when someday you want me. Well, I'll be there, wait and see. Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby, you'll be true. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me.
That was Buddy Holly and the Crickets with Maybe Baby. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Ana Castillo, right before Our Lady of Guadalupe Day. She's deep. Don't miss it. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.